Today I'm speaking with Bart Vanderhagen. Bart is a management consultant from Belgium who has spent the last 20 years working with organizations on problems related to growth, performance, and productivity. 5 years ago, he founded his own company, Pactify, which is a new management approach for problem solving in organizations. The approach incorporates ideas from the epistemology of Karl Popper and David Deutsch, as well as concepts of behavior change like autonomy and flow. The essence of the approach is a process for increased and more distributed problem solving in organizations, thereby simultaneously driving both productivity and engagement in the organization. The conversation itself was really fun. However, we did have some issues with the recording, and so we ended up using raw Skype audio for Bart's side of it. So there'll be a discrepancy there in quality between my track and his. And also, Skype always records both sides of the conversation. So whenever I make a noise or say something while Bart is speaking, you'll hear me from the Skype recording. The content, however, is dope, and I'm excited to bring you this conversation. So here's Bart Vanderhagen. All right, I'm here with Bart Vanderhagen. Bart, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Christopher. Nice talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So you're from Belgium, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And I tried to look it up beforehand. It seems like you have three official languages, Dutch, French, and German. Is that right as well?
Yes, that's correct. So the biggest two are Dutch and French, and then we have a small part of the country speaking German. I'm from the Dutch-speaking part.
Right. So do you speak any French at all?
Yes. I fluently speak French because we learn it very early in school, and so we practice it in business as well. So if you go to the capital of Belgium, you'll see that both languages are spoken in businesses and in organizations. So German is a lot less, but French, I practice a lot.
Then I'm going to give you the phrase that made me pass my French class when I was in high school. So, je suis un très beau garçon. Excusez-moi, je suis en retard.
I'm a very nice guy. Sorry for being late.
Yes. Yeah. I learned that it was I'm a pretty looking guy or something like that. But it's gotten me very far. So I'm happy with it. So I thought we could start by you giving us a little background of who you are and what it is you do, and then we can take it from there.
Yeah. So 20 years ago, I graduated as an engineer with a major in physics. I was extremely interested in physics already from, let's say, my 10th year or so. And business life or starting to work actually has channeled me into management consulting quite quickly. So I didn't really immediately pick up on things that I learned in my university, but I went into management consulting immediately after university. Management consulting being the professional service activity where you advise organizations on transformations they go through. For example, they integrate a company, or they have to integrate companies that they acquire, or they have to launch growth programs or restructuring programs, all those kinds of problems. And as a management consultant, you help organizations to find solutions, implement solutions, refine solutions. So, but the love for physics has always been there, remained there. And so it's both things. I mean, I love trying to update my knowledge and my understanding about physics, while at the same time enjoy working with organizations already for the last 20 years.
Interesting. So how did you go from physics to management consulting? What made you make that jump? Because it doesn't sound like the classic thing to do.
For one, the main option after studying what I studied was basically to go and pursue a PhD, a prospect which I didn't really find that attractive because I was a bit afraid of the solitary work, and I was very interested in solving problems and working in teams to solve problems. So management consulting is like a very good entry when you start business life, especially when you're interested in solving problems, working together in teams. And that prospect was more attractive to me than like pursuing an academic career. You don't apply immediately your direct knowledge, but you apply problem solving skills to other domains of knowledge. And that made the jump, in retrospect, quite logical and definitely not regrettable.
Is the physics background something you feel have helped you in your line of work that you do now?
I think especially in terms of problem solving, analytical focus on problems. Also, the basic ideas that can never be true of something, but that you have to always, you know, look for errors, look for improvements in what you tend to think is a good solution or what a company can benefit from. And so I started into reading epistemology only later and fairly recently, but already in having experienced the scientific method, there are obviously a lot of similarities and in your way of thinking. Like, and one of the main things is exactly like never be 100% sure of your solution. Always question it. Always try to improve it by seeking errors in it. And that, as we know, is regardless of the domain that you're working in, be it science, be it organizations, be it anything else.
Yeah. So I thought we could start, me being a complete newbie when it comes to company structure and management consulting in general. So I thought maybe we could start with you explaining to us what a typical company structure looks like, and then we can go into what the problems are with that.
Yeah. Yeah, so typically companies are structured in what we call a hierarchy, a pyramid, which is basically dividing the expertises or the domains of knowledge into clearly designated places. And those designated places are linked together hierarchically in layers up until a single individual at the end or at the top being the CEO. And so this is the, it's a bit black and white, but this has been the prevailing or the dominant way of structuring people that have to perform work. We give people assignments, responsibilities within clearly focused and scoped departments. And those departments, we're putting them in this kind of pyramid, and they go up all the end into a single entity being the CEO and cascaded down in the same way. So very structured and pyramidical. That's the classical, let's say, philosophy of how to go about in structuring people that need to work together in organizations.
So what does that entail when it comes to decision making? Is that a pyramid where the decision making is almost always made top down?
It has the tendency, for sure, as you point out, that if the decision cannot be made in like a single entity in the pyramid, the tendency or the natural flow is to escalate it and to take it one level up. And if it's not possible to take the decision there, it's escalated upwards again. And so the tendency can be very strong that because problems in organizations become more complex and become more overlapping across many departments, that any single department is not capable to take a complete decision, and therefore we escalate, and that eventually ends up in a situation where indeed on average more of the decisions and more of the thinking is done at the top and sent down as a result of that, as opposed to a more, let's say, balanced or spread out decision making across the entire pyramid, across the entire organization.
Right. Okay, because I, like I said, I have limited experience of this, but I currently work extra at a bank. And so I sit and I meet the customer each day. And in that bank, at least, the decisions, all the decisions, as far as I can tell, on how to go about our day-to-day tasks as the bank salesman, those decisions are taken by the CEOs, the people at the top, people who aren't always in touch with the reality of what we're actually doing there. So usually you see decisions being made that all the people on the ground floor we think are idiotic and inefficient. And we can see quite quickly that it won't be the most proficient way to do things. But there's not really a good feedback mechanism for error correction here. Because even if we think this, there's a very lengthy process for us to try to get this across to the people at the top who actually make the decisions. Is this something that's common?
Yeah. And I believe that it's a consequence of, again, the escalation procedure. So the people, let's say, lower in the organization with direct interaction with customers, they have plenty of information, plenty of interaction, and plenty of ideas. But given the fact that indeed the problem solving mostly is done higher up, through the cascading of that information, through the cascading of those IDs, a lot of information is lost. A lot of details about IDs, details about things around a customer problem get lost simply because of the fact that you're sending everything to a single point out of many points. And that leads to the situation that those that make the decision act upon much less information, more generalized information, more error-prone information as a consequence. And therefore, their decisions, well, while they may work to some extent, they don't contain the insights, the knowledge, always that has been gathered at the relevant levels, where at the levels where the interaction with the customers takes place. And I think it's simply an effect or a consequence of the fact that we are sending a lot of the questions, problems, and potential solutions or ideas from many places upwards towards a single place, and a lot of it get lost in that process, and you end up typically very general type of solutions, solutions that don't match the real problem anymore, that are directionally relevant, but specifically not real solutions or not the most effective solutions. And again, it's a consequence of the way we organize work and the decision we take on where to solve the problems in that structure.
Yeah, it reminds me of the, I don't know what it's called, but the whisper game you used to play in middle school, where you would get a word or a sentence and you would all stand in a circle and then you whisper to the person next to you. And then they have to try to hear what you say and whisper to the next person. And so once it's gone through the entire circle, the resulting sentence or word is usually completely different than what the first person said.
Yeah, that's exactly the mechanism that that takes place, and it's a consequence of some kind of weird decision that apparently the last one in your circle is entitled to give the final say, which is in itself suboptimal. And but the dynamics behind are exactly the ones that you described with that example. It's exactly the same.
Yeah, so you lose the nuance. And also, like you said, the maybe the localized knowledge that is best created on a certain level.
You also lose error correction, because if you would allow the problem to be solved lower in the organization for a longer time, then at that place you can allow for longer error correction. Whereas typically in the cascading, you go up and immediately there's a decision and immediately it goes down. And so the opportunity for error correction is almost even absent, because you have to follow up on the decision that has been made without any opportunity typically to subject it to criticism or to error correction.
Right. So as most of the people I assume listening to this podcast already know, this is a fundamental issue epistemologically, because this sounds like it's basically justificationism or authoritarianism, where we're just assuming that the people at the top know better.
Yeah.
But so what is it that you do then, and what is it that you do differently from this?
Yeah, so what we do is still problem solving like any consultant or management consultancy. So we go to organizations that struggle with problems like how do we need to integrate companies? How do we need to create more value for stakeholders? How do we increase loyalty with customers? So the problems stay the same, but we have another system for problem solving. So we vary on the system which we come to describe, the, let's say, hierarchical system where problems are typically solved higher up, where the thinking mostly is done higher up and then cascaded down and upwards again. So what we do is we start simply by allowing the problem solving to be done at other places and typically the places where the problem manifests itself and where people around the problem basically have the knowledge, have the ideas, have the means to criticize and error correct solutions. And so we avoid this dynamic of we only gather information in the organization, we send it upwards, and the problem solving is done at the higher level. So we start by giving problems, asking questions to relevant places in the organization, and we set teams, carefully selected teams, upon those problems. And so to start with, we're not sending the problem upwards, we're sending the problems and the questions downwards. And we keep them there because you need a process then for optimum problem solving to occur in those teams and not to have that intervened with some kind of escalation again of the problem and another solution coming from the top to disrupt the whole dynamic. So you need a specific problem solving process in those teams. Essentially, it's about asking questions, having people own ideas and safeguard the execution of ideas, the improvement of their ideas, the alignment of other people in the teams on those ideas, basically the error correction and the criticism organized at the place of the problem as opposed to, you know, further away and with the danger of making generalizations of both the problem and the solution.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds similar to, I don't remember who has written about this example specifically, but the idea of the knowledge problem within political philosophy, the idea that, the one central organ, the state, can't possibly know the best way to farm for farmers, and yet they're supposed to make all the decision about how to farm rather than locally letting the farmers decide what's best. So it sounds like a big part of this is creating a space for more autonomy at each level or each department of the organization to contribute to their own problem solving rather than just delegating everything to the top. And I heard you say something along the lines of asking questions. I would assume that one way to do this is for the top to provide different questions or problems to work on rather than giving specific orders of what to do. Is this somewhat correct?
Yes, that's correct. And it's a very important point because you immediately get into the question. So what is the role of the hierarchy then? If you say we're sending out problems and we're allowing people to take up autonomy in terms of coming up with own ideas and refining their ideas with colleagues, what is the role of the hierarchy? What is the role of the immediate leadership then? And you point out one very important aspect of that already is that they have to basically fuel that problem-solving process first by organizing it and in the beginning even commanding it, so requiring participation in that process, because problem-solving, when you change the place of it in the organization, it doesn't happen spontaneously. It doesn't all of a sudden create magical solutions among people that, you know, are not used to this or doing this before. So and the hierarchy has to organize the problem solving process in a way that people get together, come together, participate in it. And then additionally, secondly, as you point out, ask the right questions as opposed to pushing their solutions into those teams, understanding what the questions are that the team either has not discovered themselves or that could add to the existing IDs in the team. And so there's a very active role of the hierarchy in this type of fueling of the problem solving. And so they need to be interested and understand the emerging IDs in the teams and then react upon those by asking questions in order to either refute some of the bad ideas, let's say, that's perfectly possible, but then stimulate new ideas or the growth of ideas or the you know, the broader scope of the solutions that are being built. And so there's a very active role, which is different than the classical, but which is key in making this work.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important point, because I think it's easy to hear, okay, there are issues with this form of pyramid hierarchical structure. And so it might be easy to jump to, okay, so maybe a completely flat organization would be the best solution then. And I know that in Sweden we have, I don't know how it is in Belgium, but in Sweden we have more of those types of organizations. And what I hear you say is that basically we need some type of structure. No hierarchy could be just as bad as too strict of an hierarchy. And we don't necessarily want the HR people to be in charge of cybersecurity or whatever.
Yeah, but even more important than the structure, because we typically don't tend to pay too much attention to structure, because a lot of companies also make, I guess, the mistake of changing their structures all the time, either flattening them, but then again, building layers into them when they see that things don't work. And you get into sometimes some kind of endless repetition of organizational redesigns, where the one redesign goes up onto the other. We try to stay away from the structure as such, but we focus on the problem solving and the ideation, because an idea, a good idea to solve a problem, basically doesn't care about the structure in which it evolves, be it flat, be it hierarchical. It's about the ideas, and it's about how the ideas grow and how people add to ideas, or how people can find errors in ideas. And basically, structure is never the ideal fit upon a good idea. And so the ideas need to get room and be in a process where they can grow, where they can gradually contribute to progress that is transparent. And the structure is like secondary in terms of importance. And oftentimes, too much of the thinking goes into the question, do we have the right structure? My plea is to orient more and more of the thinking about, are we thinking about the right problems? Are the right people thinking about the right problems? And do we have a good process in which that thinking results in like a continuous growth of ideas and knowledge to solve those problems? And it can happen basically almost independent of the concrete structure in which those problems are solved.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds fairly alike Karl Popper's distinction between who should rule and, yeah, how do we create a system that's more conducive to error correction? We had a short chat before this, and I know that you mentioned reductionism and the idea of emergence in a company. So I want to ask you quickly about that before we go into the next layer here, which is motivation, cooperation, how we foster and drive problem solving within a corporation. But let's start with the reductionism and emergence.
Yeah. So a lot of what we've been saying about typical organization is built upon theories about management that are, in my view, too reductionist. So where what we try to achieve, which is typically in an organization, it's about performance, productivity, and engagement. All those things that we try to achieve are based or are organized with too much of a reductionist theory. We reduce success, performance, productivity to some basic, simple, individualized components. So either somebody needs to get a new responsibility, or we need to have a specific structure for a new type of problem. But all of those things are reductionist in the way that they reduce the result to one or a couple individual components that they try to tweak and control and retweak. But everything which has to do with success and performance is basically emerging from a structure and emerging after a long period of good evolution, optimal evolution, just in the way that evolution works in nature, that evolution works in real strong explanations and real good theories. You need a process in which emergence can take place. And if you're controlling individual components with a too strong focus only on those components, and then you think if we add this all together up, we will get to the ideal outcome, that doesn't work, because things like behavior, knowledge creation, all of those things are emergent. And so you can't get there by dissecting those things into individual discrete components and then controlling and tweaking any of those components with the aspiration or the hope that when you do so, that like the collective result will then be optimum. It just doesn't work that way. It works in very simple situations and very simple problems. But given the problems that organizations face today, the fact that they're complex, that they spread over entire organizations, that you cannot isolate them anymore to one specific department or one specific expertise, all of those things that are making problems more complex also are an argument for throwing away all those reductionist type of theories when we want to drive success, productivity, and all those things.
So can you give a practical example of how such a reductionist theory would be implemented in practice? Like what sort of factors would be examples that you could tweak on such a model?
Yeah, well, a typical, very simple example is you give a person a responsibility. It could be, make sure that the sales are growing with 5% next year. And then at the end of that year, the sales, for example, only have grown by 2 or 3%. The reductionist approach is, well, the one and only flaw or the one and only mistake that has been made here is that individual person has not taken his responsibility, because his responsibility was to grow 5%. And then typically the person is fired and is replaced, and they repeat the same exercise over and over again. And some persons may achieve the 5% and others won't. But the reductionist flaw is that you reduce the success, being the 5%, to only that single individual responsibility, whereas growing by 5% implies an interaction between many, many, many different people, many different ideas, many different situations that have all that all need to add up to that result, and you cannot reduce it to the responsibility of one single individual, especially if, for example, as I said, the market is changing, the market is becoming much more complex, customer demands are much more ambiguous and volatile and complex, and then to reduce the success only to this one individual who didn't succeed in getting to 5% is extremely reductionist and therefore flawed in all ways you can think about this.
Right. So you're saying in the larger picture, the results of any said company, of any company, is an emergent phenomenon of the company as a whole and can't be fully reduced to one person's responsibility. Yeah, it fascinates me that is how most companies are still operating today, when we have such a high level of interaction globally for most companies. It seems fairly glaringly obvious that can't be the way to do it. But yeah, you're saying that most people are doing that. But
creationism as well. I mean, we need to. We have this natural tendency to isolate the error to very, very simple ingredients and very isolated ingredients, because then we can act upon them. It's like a thinking flaw in management to want to reduce all kinds of outcomes to only very simple components of it. And obviously, the more complex things become, the less correct those type of thinking or those types of explanations are.
Yeah, and yet, at the same time, personal responsibility, I would guess, has some role to play as well, because an individual has to perform to a certain degree for the emergence to be able to take place as well. So you can't completely neglect personal responsibility either.
Exactly, but you can exaggerate it. And we tend to exaggerate it, and we should go much more in terms of shared responsibilities, where individual responsibility is still clear and transparent, but there is this more sharing of responsibility, because the best ideas to achieve that 5% sales growth inherently will have to come from many people and from many iterations. And so we need a process in which the knowledge growth and the share or is a shared responsibility. And if we exaggerate in separating responsibilities too much, you'll end up with behavior where you're creating silos, where people are reluctant to share information that is of vital importance to somebody else in achieving his or her goals. And the more we exaggerate on this reductionist over, let's say, emphasizing of individual responsibilities, the more you create a behavior where the sharing, where the evolution of knowledge, where the interaction, the iterations are all becoming more and more suboptimal.
Yeah, I mean, if you as an individual have a certain responsibility and you have very high expectations to perform, let's say, these 5%, that result that you mentioned, a vital part of being able to error correct is to voice your opinions that might be wrong. I mean, you can't correct an idea if you're not putting it under scrutiny and putting it forth to be criticized. And I feel like that is something that's extremely misunderstood, not only in a workplace, but in general in our culture. I mean, if you see at university, for me right now, people are very reluctant to raise their hand and answer a question wrongly, even if that's what they think the answer is. They would rather be quiet and not say the wrong answer than saying something. And by saying something that is wrong, you are essentially gaining insight into the problem that you were trying to answer. I mean, it's very essential, and it's a shame that, people feel ashamed to have the wrong answer, which we must expect all the time if we're going to make any progress at all.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's really a shame. And the irony is that you're doing something extremely positive and progress oriented when you're questioning yourself and others, or at least the ideas of yourself and others, because you shouldn't criticize people, but ideas. But by doing so, you're doing something extremely valuable, something extremely positive, i.e. you're contributing to potential progress, to potential innovation. And the organization where everyone is afraid to question what other people say or to not dare to speak up about what they think can improve is an organization which is static, which won't survive in these times.
Yeah. No, I think, and this is slightly off topic, but just quickly, I think that psychologically we tend to, because of faulty epistemology, I presume, and a faulty idea of what a person is in general, that my ideas are me. If I put forth an idea here and you criticize it, it's similar to you attacking a part of my body. It's rather than seeing it as a shared arena where we just throw out ideas that has nothing to do with our personhood. It's just an idea, and then we can shape them together in that arena, and then we can come out with a better idea altogether that we can then put into our arsenal. I mean, it's that's one of the more liberating insights that I've gained from the whole Popperian and Deutschian perspective, that you never have to identify with the ideas in any real sense. You can always just use the best ideas you have at your disposal. And then as soon as you find a better idea, that's great. That's good news. You have literally nothing to lose in a conversation. Either your ideas survive all criticism and you can be more happy to continue using them, or you're getting a good criticism and you might find better ideas and leave with more knowledge. I mean, it's a win-win situation.
Yeah, exactly. For me personally also, I mean, coming to that insight from the epistemological background of it was extremely insightful. But then on the other hand, as Karl Popper mentions it, a tradition of criticism is what is needed, but it's very hard to get at. But once you have it, you're in a state as an organization, for example, for almost unlimited progress. But creating this tradition of criticism is obviously that is the big challenge, and where you need these type of processes and learning experiences, because the alternative, being the hierarchy, will also lead to behavior where people entrench themselves into their expertise and only their expertise, and never questioning their expertise, very little sharing of expertise with others, and so you get basically the opposite tradition, and it's crucial to in a developmental way deconstruct the old tradition and construct the new tradition.
Is this something that you push hard early on, this purely epistemological point of the importance of a tradition of criticism?
I'm not so much of a pusher in terms of theories and models, because the fact of the matter is that people only learn and experience while doing and while experiencing what the new process or the new system delivers. And so it's more start small and grow from what goes well and leave out what doesn't work well. And literally in an evolutionary way, and that's also how we come into organizations. Typically, we start on a particular problem with our specific process, and as problems are abundant and inevitable, we can grow into other areas of problems with other teams, and eventually create a movement which started very small, which is scalable. Mm. And so I'm not a believer in trying to find the CEO whom I can convince of this and revolutionize all of what he built his company upon and how he. So it's an right. evolutionary way which often takes time, which is maybe not as sexy as like any Big Bang revolution. But because we're essentially talking about dynamics that are comparable to evolution, we can also not, it goes faster, obviously, than natural evolution or biological evolution, because we're working with ideas and knowledge creation. But still, evolution has its process, and that process, cannot be forced into higher speeds than the one that comes out of it.
Yeah, piecemeal improvement, and every point is a starting point, as Popper said. All right, folks, time for the fun stuff. If you enjoy my podcast and you want to support it, you can now become a monthly Patreon supporter at patreon.com/doexplain. Or if you'd rather make a one-time donation, you can visit ko-fi.com/doexplain instead. That is ko-fi.com/doexplain. Perhaps ask yourself, what would Jesus do? And surely, Jesus would donate to Do Explain. Another way to make the podcast grow and improve is to tell people you know who you think would enjoy it to check it out. Because with more support and exposure, I'll be able to improve the podcast continually and produce more content, which is something that I would love to do. Lastly, thank you so much to all of you who've donated so far. It truly means the world to me, and I want to extend my gratitude. Back to enjoying the show. So I'd like to shift the focus a little bit, and I know you have a lovely TED Talk on YouTube called Flow, the Real Driver of Autonomy and Cooperation in Organizations. And I thought we could start with the motivational aspect of this and how it ties into corporations. So you outline in the talk, as far as I remember, two different forms of motivation, the stick and carrot motivation and the intrinsic motivation. So if you could explicate this a little bit, that would be great.
Yeah. So the difference between both sources of motivation is the one comes from the outside and the other one comes from what you're doing, your activity, your thinking, your doing. The extrinsic part is basically, you know, you get either a reward or you get punished if you don't do, you know, what you're told to do. The motivation comes from something after the activity and something that is independent of the activity, which is typically a reward or the avoidance of a punishment. That's the source of motivation, but it has nothing to do with what you're specifically doing, what problem you're specifically solving, what ideas you are working out specifically. And so that's extrinsic. Intrinsic is all kinds of motivation that come from doing what you're doing. Autonomy is an important one, which is basically the freedom to choose how you want to progress in what you're doing and to not be controlled in any way or shape in either what you're doing or how you want to make progress in what you're doing. And the second is purpose, belief. So what you're doing can lead to a certain belief that it's more or that it has more reach than the simple activity. It could be, you know, improving something for your community, society, even the world. And so the belief that what you're doing contributes to something with a higher scope or a broader scope than the immediate activity is also a source of intrinsic motivation. The second one, and then you have a third one, which is flow, which is basically the enjoyment of doing what you're doing while you're doing and the enjoyment of your progress while you're making progress and in function of what you're doing and in function of the problem you encounter and the solution you find while you're doing what you're doing. It's basically the enjoyment of the activity in itself for the purpose of the activity.
Yeah, so the stick and carrot, the external motivation could be simple things as, okay, I don't want to get fired. That's something I want to avoid. So therefore, it motivates me not to try to get fired, or I want a higher salary, or yeah, you're chasing the carrot or avoiding the stick. And the intrinsic, like you said, it's yeah, you're doing it for the fascination of the task itself. And I know that this is kind of counterintuitive to people. And I know in the self-help culture, which I personally was very, very immersed in before I found David Deutsch's work and Popper's work. And I know Tony Robbins. Do you know Tony Robbins?
Yes, I see who he is.
Yeah, and he always talks about avoiding pain and going towards pleasure. And it's one of his staples that we want to avoid pain more than we want to receive pleasure. So to motivate yourself, you should visualize. He has this example, or at least he used to. I don't know if he's still using it, but an example of visualizing yourself when you're 80 years old and you're sitting in a rocking chair at home and thinking back upon your life. And then you envision not living up to all the goals you had and all the dreams you had and how horrible you'll feel. And continually thinking about that will be the factor that motivates you to do things. And then we have on the completely other end of the spectrum, we have people like David Deutsch and his fun criterion, which to me sounds very close to what you call flow. The idea that having fun is an indication that you're actually growing knowledge, that your ideas are all taking each other into account, and that you're not using any form of justificationism where you say that your explicit ideas, for instance, have authority over your implicit ideas, and you're just going to blindly say that, okay, I feel bad about going to the gym, but I have an idea that it's good, so I'm just going to run right over one part of myself. But what does the science say of stick and carrot versus intrinsic motivation? I know this was something you mentioned in your TED talk.
Yeah. So first of all, and not to have any misconceptions, but carrot and stick, they work really well. Eh? So companies are built upon those type of motivators. Eh? So it's not like you cannot say black and white that the one works and the other don't. But what science does say is that, and the distinction is here, like for simple tasks, let's say, you're doing work, you're standing on an assembly line. And when you give like a certain carrot or a certain, in that case, a salary increase, when you're speeding up the assembly line, people will work harder. So for very simple, let's say, algorithmic tasks, the carrot works. If you increase the carrot, people will produce more output. If you threaten more with the stick, then people will also produce more output, because there is this simplicity of the task, which doesn't really intervene with the prospect of the reward or the threat of the punishment. And so in all those kind of cases, carrot and stick are perfectly fine motivators.
So, sorry to interrupt you, but real quick, could you say that would be because these tasks don't really require the creation of any new knowledge?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's the point where I was coming to in saying that carrot and stick doesn't work optimally anymore, and even counterproductively, which is fascinating. Everywhere where there is problem solving of a complexity that is higher than, let's say, the algorithmical problems, where there is a simple sequence of tasks to perform in order to solve your problems, and you do it iteratively in the same way, and then you can increase your productivity when you're promised a carrot. But when problems become complex, studies have shown this, your productivity or your efficiency actually goes down. And that was explained by the fact that if your mind is focused on a particular complex problem, and at the same time you're giving the prospect of a carrot, we try to confuse both, or we don't have enough space in our minds to accommodate both. So you cannot incentivize with money or with carrots a complex problem. You will see that it works counterproductively, because people either focus on creating knowledge, solving complex problems, or they're doing algorithmical stuff just to get, you know, the reward. But you cannot mix both. And if you do, you're actually getting a counterproductive result, which was actually fascinating and interesting to see that it's not only ineffective, it's even counterproductive.
Yeah, no, that's, and that's, on the face of it, that's kind of a counterintuitive point, I think. I mean, obviously it is, since companies are still employing this type of external motivation. But so, okay, so basically you're saying that when you have a task that you can automatically do without thinking about it, it helps if you can just basically think about the reward while doing that. I know my wife went to Alaska one summer for 6 weeks to work on a fishing boat. She's crazy, that woman, and I would never be able to do this, but she worked there and they just fished all day, and she said every fish, the only thing she did when she was sorting them was counting each dollar that she was going to make. That was the only way to get through that. And but when you have a complex problem, you want to be completely immersed in the problem, and you don't want to be, a reward is a distraction, thinking about the reward.
Yeah, and the distraction actually makes that the problem solving suffers from it, which is quite hallucinating, because you're paying the carrot, obviously costs money. It costs money to the organization, and you're getting counterproductive problem solving for it in return. So you lose twice, and till it's being done. And well, obviously maybe a lot of the things I'm saying are a bit black and white. Organizations are obviously aware of this, and they are experimenting and testing things. Basically underlying all of this is that the move and the change and the evolution needs to go still, faster, and needs to go more profoundly. And we're starting, luckily, to discover all of this science and now converting them or converting those ideas into systems that allow for organizations to more effectively solve problems and do that while engaging at the same time all of their people. That's the end goal, and there we're maybe still far away from that point. But luckily, organizations are starting to reflect about this. But the system that will get them there is going to have to be a new system. So they cannot just infuse this into the classical system of problem solving, into the classical pyramids. They will have to find out a system in which this new behavior and these new types of problem solving processes are organized. And that will be in a different way than the traditional one.
Yeah. Google is a company that instantly comes to mind where, at least as far as I've heard, they have I don't know if they have it for all employees, but they have a day or a certain allotted period of time each week where people can work on whatever problems they find interesting, completely freely chosen. And they have, during that time, come up with some of the most famous inventions that have ever come from Google. And that's a very interesting point there.
Google taps into, because it shows the duality between autonomy and flow. So Google taps into the autonomy part. They literally give one day without any instruction, without any mandate. I think the only thing they say is come and present us every so many weeks your progress.
Right.
But they don't give any targets. They don't give any specific instructions. Okay. That's the first and necessary part, which is giving the autonomy. Now, the second part, equally crucial, is accepting autonomy and turning it into flow. Because you can give a lot of people freedom, but performance and progress doesn't happen spontaneously from the fact that you give freedom. And so the second part is equally as important. And in the case of Google, I'm sure that there are dynamics that make for people also achieving to get into flow and produce those great new ideas and those great new products. For example, the fact that you have to present it every once in a while will, in a sense, already, you know, trigger them to make a plan, to structure their work, to bounce off ideas and get started. But a lot of companies have copied the Google ID in thinking that, well, as long as we just give them this one day, out will come those great ideas. And they're lacking the second part. They're lacking the process in which people actually accept the autonomy and turn it into new ideas, new knowledge, new experiments, new progress, and all of those things. And that really requires a process as opposed to just, you know, giving a little present of autonomy. And it's only when you get both right that out will come all those great new products. And it's the second part that is the hardest one to get, because you can give freedom to anyone. It just costs you probably a little bit of short-term productivity. But making sure that people accept the autonomy and turn it into flow, which leads to all these new great ideas, knowledge, and products, that is the crucial thing. And that's the interesting part. And probably at Google, you know, you have these great, exciting, entrepreneurial people that, you know, that have five ideas every hour. But we need to get that same effect in, let's say, more traditional companies where you don't have five ideas per hour, where you're not working on the most sexy technology that ever existed on Earth, but where you also have people with the capacity to think and with an engagement to go for it. And so there it's about also giving, obviously, autonomy, but helping them to accept it and turn it into flow. Even if it deals with, I don't know what, selling insurances or whatever, it doesn't matter what you do. It's about, creating ideas, growing those ideas, turning those ideas into own results and doing it together in teams and regardless of the sexiness of your business.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. And I want to explore that a little more a little later on. But so is it fair to say then that autonomy is a necessary condition for creative output, but it's not a sufficient one then.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And flow is the one which is crucial.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of similar to the discussion of universal basic income, for instance. There's a big discussion about meaning, that work is what provides people with meaning. And if you take away the work, what will people do, basically? But that also seems to be a mistake in terms of external versus intrinsic motivation. Yeah, I'm motivated to go to a job because I need to go to the job to get my pay, rather than finding out, not only on the company level like you're talking about, but even at the individual level, how to help people find this flow, so that once we can automate all the boring tasks and boring jobs and people can actually open up more free time in their lives, that they don't just sit at home and get stuck in the autonomy part, but can't reach the flow side of the equation.
And that would be a disastrous outcome of that one rule, if that would turn out to be the outcome. Yeah.
Nah, yeah, for sure. But so let's go into flow a little more then. What is it on a closer inspection? And why is it important? I guess we've touched that, but we can go into that a little more.
So it's the, as I said, the enjoyment of what you're doing, but based upon what you're doing specifically. And so not based upon everything else you could think about, which will come in the future or which happened in the past. It's the pure and total focus on your activity, what you're doing, and how the activity is progressing. The concept was coined by a Hungarian psychologist, which is the unpronounceable name Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, whom I had the pleasure to meet and to discuss with. The great thing about his work is that actually he didn't describe it like what I often read in terms of descriptions of psychological effects, is that you purely describe it in terms of what happens and how it looks like. He figured out also what the conditions were or the causes that make you experience flow. And obviously, as a big fan of David Deutsch, I was immediately triggered by his explanation of flow, which goes effectively deeper than simply describing it, just in the way as I did it just now, being the focus on your work, forgetting all of the rest. That's just the description of the effect. But Mihai Csikszentmihalyi also discovered the explanation and therefore the causes, the things that make you experience flow. And they boil down to three simple causes or origins of experiencing flow. And so he did all kinds of study to come up with these. And they're very practical. It doesn't require a psychology degree to understand them. They're basically, first of all, whatever you do or every action, every single action that you perform should have a clear goal, as opposed to being some kind of random action without any direction. That's the first rule. The second rule is that while you're doing what you're doing, you pay close attention to the progress you're making. In terms of visual observation or cognitive reflection on your progress. So you're very much focused on how am I going from, you know, the one step to the other step, and you're capturing that type of feedback while you're doing it. And the third condition is that there always has to be a balance between the difficulty of what you're doing and the skill level you have. So when they're out of balance, you're either bored because it's too easy, or you're getting frustrated because it's too difficult. And those conditions together actually give you, even if you like, a manual for regardless whatever kind of activity or task, to find more and more flow and to maintain flow and to keep yourself from losing flow. And that's just really interesting that it's also regardless of the type of activity. So you can experience flow when you're ironing your skirts as well as when you're playing tennis.
Yeah, I iron a lot of my skirts all day. Yeah, I have a lot of skirts.
Yeah, well, you can either do it because you have to do it and because that feels like an obligation, or you can, experience flow in a way that, you you try to understand how you can iron it more perfectly, more productively, figure out ideas on how to do that, test those ideas, experiment, learn from it. All those types of ways of ironing skirts are the ones that will induce flow, whereas the alternative, doing it because you have to do it and complaining all the time and thinking about type of things you can do afterwards is obviously the way of doing it without flow. But it doesn't necessarily depend on the type of activity. It depends on how you organize it and how you drive the activity.
So that kind of gives some credence to the idea of if you can't do what you love, love what you do.
Yeah.
Like you can always find a way to that. That's something that I wanted to ask you a little later on, because my wife asked me this morning that, how to make, let's say you have a job that you really enjoy doing, as she does, but then you have certain parts of the job, let's say some administrative tasks that you just think are so boring. How to, in practice, make those tasks, conducive to flow or conducive to, progress. But you're saying that it ties into trying to fit these three criteria into whatever task you're doing.
Yeah, and it's possible to some extent. It's definitely possible if you focus on it, and it becomes harder and harder if you simply don't believe that it's possible. So it also has to do with, are you open to experiment? Are you open to allow ideas, for example, to reorganize the way you're doing your administrative tasks, or changing the timing of them, or changing the sequence, or whatever, discussing it with somebody else to get ideas. It all starts with obviously ideas on how to do things different in a way that difference excites you and that difference triggers you to continue to do it differently and to acknowledge the progress you're making into it. And obviously, there's a saturation point. Eh? You will not endlessly grow flow, because if the tasks remain essentially the same, like you have with administrative tasks, I don't see a countless number of variations of doing it. There are variations in how to do it and organize yourself, but they're not countless. Any type of activity will at some point generate a sort of saturation, but then you can go to the level of how you organize different types of activities throughout a day, throughout a week, how you share tasks with others, or how you rotate tasks in a team, and etc. So the human creativity is in principle endless for coming up with ideas to do certain perceived boring tasks differently and work on those ideas and even again error correct them for not allowing progress or not leading to progress. And as long as you keep that going, you will experience more flow. And when you stop experiencing flow, go to the next level, discuss it with colleagues, try to find again new ideas to do the same boring thing differently, with another effect on progress.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, because if Deutsch's fun criterion is true and having fun or being in flow is a result of actively creating knowledge within a certain area, then as long as you're trying to make whatever task you're doing better, you are effectively creating knowledge while doing it. And I think for the other end there, which is the saturation point, even with really fascinating problems, you'll have times where you feel like you don't want to do that anymore and you want to go do something else. So I guess that's where the importance of the non-coercive element or the autonomy is. Yeah, that's why that is very important as well, to be able to choose more when you're interested in working in a particular problem or not. So the three criteria of flow, if I remember them, was you need a clear goal, you need to track your progress, have a feedback mechanism there, and you want the difficulty to be just right. But so I just want to push back a little on the first criterion there, because I'm not sure what a clear goal means then, because I can think of many things that one does that is fairly goalless as far as I can see it, and still extremely fun or intriguing, or I feel like you could be in flow doing something that doesn't have at least an explicit clear goal in doing it.
Yeah, but the point here is that it has to be goals for your actions. So we're not talking about like big goals on the horizon or very far away inspiring goals. It's about specific goals for your actions, your real, the individual steps, actions that you're taking. So if you would take the example of tennis, playing tennis, the clear goals to remain in flow are specifically that for every movement of your racket or your arm, you know exactly and with a very clear meaning why you know it, where you want the ball to land, because you want to get the other person in trouble. And so you have a very precise idea of why you're doing what you're doing, why you're going to hit the ball with that speed and with that curvature and in that and in that direction. And it's a matter of concentration. It's a way to concentrate, but it's not directly, it doesn't have to do with the classical way of talking about goals, in the sense that they have to be big and aspirational and purposeful and out of the comfort zone and all that kind of thing. So it's more at the level of the action itself.
Yeah. No, then I understand. So you're not saying that the goal would be something like, I want to win the tennis game per se. It's more, like you said there, the specific movements to solve a particular problem in each line of the way there. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's basically the same as saying that the goal is always making the most optimal incremental progress. And in terms of activities, that's essentially your action. Your next action, and why you're doing that action, and with what goal, and for what type of incremental progress that you want to aim for. And eventually all those things add up into, you know, winning your tournament, becoming the world number one, having a great life. Yeah. But flow is always related to the specific activity, the specific problem you're solving, and the specific type of progress you want to achieve in that activity.
Yeah, and that ties back to what you said before, that you don't want to be distracted by thinking about the future or playing a tennis game at high level. You don't want to be thinking about your next game and how you need to win that to win the tournament, because then you won't be in flow by definition. Yeah, no, that's fascinating. I find this very, very interesting, and I'm glad that you're out there spreading the science on this and using it in practice as well to spread the news, because this is we need more of this. Before I want to end on the problem with standard HR methodology to a large extent, because my wife works within HR and she was really interested to hear your critiques of the standard models there. But first, I just want to ask, as far as I understand, you... I don't think we've mentioned the name of your company, Pactify. And you started that 5 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And you told me that you didn't stumble over Popper and Deutsch until in the middle there sometime. So I'm curious how coming across their work and understanding those epistemological principles changed the results you were seeing with companies and changed your approach in general?
Yeah, the short answer is that it changed immensely. I started out 5 years ago with this notion of flow and behavior. And, you know, the transition from carrot and stick towards intrinsic motivation, but coming across Deutsch and Popper, basically, you know, expanded my thinking, you know, in all kinds of directions, and not necessarily contrary directions, because even flow is a way of problem solving in the most optimum way, by error correction in the action, by allowing new ideas to evolve while you're doing what you're doing. So it's maybe not a coincidence that you know, my thinking got expanded and not reversed or redirected. But I always say that those books struck me like a meteorite. The epistemological consequence of like anything you read from that is so huge, and it builds on the one idea on the other. And when you're reading Deutsch, like every sentence merits another book almost, and he goes on building upon the previous sentence, going on to the next one. And yeah, it's been extremely valuable. There were parts of it already present in Pactify, but obviously it has evolved through the work of, or reading the work of, Deutsch and Popper. What was present was already from the beginning is this notion that companies are about problem solving. Problems are inevitable, and they lead to progress. And the way they lead to progress is by allowing for ideas to be developed at the place where the problem is, to be grown. There were parts already there, but for sure, understanding even more deeply why all of this is so valuable and merits, the pursuance of it, that really came when starting to read both of these gentlemen.
Yeah. I find it very fascinating talking to you, because I've, up until this point on the podcast, it's mostly been talking about these ideas in abstract and kind of devoid from the practical reality of things like, how do you organize a company in the most optimal way? And it's really fun to hear someone who has taken these principles and really apply them in a successful way and making progress that way. It's really cool.
I don't think it's a good idea to talk about Popper and Deutsch when I'm in organizations in order to convince them, because it's indeed like an intellectual endeavor, and it took me years, and still I'm rereading those two books, and I'm getting more of out of it with every lecture of them. But the key is to integrate those concepts into a system which is practical, which is working, which you can introduce on a small problem, which is scalable, scopable, as our system is. And the theory behind, I work on the theory in the background, but for organizations, you need to have something which works, which is built on those theories, but which allows them to learn while doing, as opposed to having to understand all of it at the outset.
Yeah. No, that sounds like a much smarter way to go about it, because just like you said, I had the same experience. I found all these ideas about, let's say, 18 months ago. And like you said, I've read Beginning of Infinity maybe 3-4 times, and each time it's almost a new book to some extent. So what is, I suppose that this differs depending on the individual company and their problem situation, but what is the easiest entry point when you come into an organization? Where do you usually start?
Well, the entry point needs to be high enough, because you need to have a kind of anchor point, typically a CEO or somebody who leads a department, or who has significant amount of both problems and people, and who has at least, I would say, like a 5 to 10% affinity for these kinds of ideas and for these kinds of concepts where you distribute the problem solving down into the organization, who can play an anchoring point to drive the adoption of the process and to endorse the process. And so, for that, I start quite high. But then we search for relevant problems and relevant teams where we can start. And those can be at 1, 2, 3, whatever levels below this person. But I need somebody at least, acting as some sort of ambassador who I can rely upon to provide the credibility that this is something that is worthwhile pursuing, that will be pursued, who's also interested in what differences this leads to, who's also interested in the kind of solutions that these teams are developing. So it takes a particular personality for this, to work, and that's where I'm looking for. But once I have a person like that who is ready to experiment with this or to at least test and allow this, then we can go wherever in the organization where it's relevant, where we find a complex problem, where we have different people that are not used to working together, but where they should work together in order to solve the problem. Then we configure the start in that way. And as I said, we expand it. We go to new problems, more problems with more people. But after a while, after we are starting to, we're starting to get traction on this first problem.
Yeah. Okay. But so what I'm curious then, what is the biggest obstacle that you face when you're trying to persuade a company that they should hire you to implement your system? Or,
well, there are a couple, but it's sad to say, but sometimes I hear the critic that even, today managers think that literally, well, we're not going to let the people solve that because they will not be able to solve it. You can hear those types of comments literally, which is obviously sad, which is hopefully not their 100% conviction. It could be fear for something new. But the ideology that, problems should be solved at the higher level, and that typically managers are sent here on earth to answer all of the questions for everyone at every moment in time, is still an ideology that you find, and it's an ideology upon which a lot of managers have become successful. And so I'm looking for the ones who understand that kind of ideology is extremely fallible. And then we have a discussion, and then we can start. But sad to say, there is a significant share of the market which basically is a little bit on the side of that still. And there is a minority who understand that kind of ideology is extremely fallible. And it's with that share of the market that I'm working. When we start, also one of the roadblocks that we encounter typically or quite often is that also people are sometimes surprised that they're asked to solve a problem, because the tendency and the tradition was that they shouldn't have the idea, that they shouldn't, exchange the ideas, build upon the ideas, pursue the ideas, because they come from a tradition where most of the people just need to either execute the work or provide the information for other people to solve the problem. Whereas in our system, we are setting up a process in which it's literally the first idea, the first guess from anyone about a problem that will be the guess and the idea upon which we're going to work, upon which that person can take ownership and will be helped in his team to grow the idea, improve the idea, execute on the idea without interference of hierarchy on the content side, but more on the process side, on the encouragement to pursue it, showing their interest in that idea. And all those kinds of things are sometimes really weird and really different from what people are used to. There are no showstoppers either, but it's what you see in the beginning.
Well, I'm glad to hear that at least some people and some companies are open to that. And you have to start somewhere. Hopefully, if this is the case, if we're right about these ideas being the best ones, then we should eventually see wider adoption of them, I would assume. I mean, if companies are getting better and better results implementing these principles, it would be silly to cling to the past anyway. But so I was thinking throughout this conversation about the similarities and the potential differences between individual problem solving and problem solving at a company level. Would you say that the most prominent difference there is that, I mean, if you're trying to solve a problem, I guess this could be argued to exist in an individual as well, as we we have a lot of inexplicit ideas that we might block off or not listen to. But I guess in a company, it's very important that the right information is available at the right level at the right time. And there's a very big need for transparency in that sense. How do you view, is there any difference between the individual level versus problem solving on the company level, or do you see them as the same?
But I see only the necessity to have collective problem solving, because the problems cannot be solved any more individually and then added up to come to the entire solution. So current markets, current complexity forces companies to go from individual problem solving to collective. It's basically a necessity. It's more difficult because you have to organize both the ideation and then the variation, the criticism, the error correction. You have to organize it collectively, and you run into much more situations of disagreement, and you can get polarization as a result of that. So it is a necessity, but it's making things a little bit more complex, because how do you get the right ideas from the right people in the right place with, you know, the most optimum error correction for the solutions to be, you know, as much as or as optimally fitting to the problems that companies face. And as we talked about, the hierarchical model, the pyramid model, for sure is not the right way to do collective problem solving. We need another way. We need another system which can go in the beginning hand in hand with the pyramid, hand in hand with the hierarchy, but where the activity of problem solving is organized in a really different way than before. But it's for sure a necessity, and it will also be, in the future, it will be the difference between surviving or going extinct, surviving and thriving versus going extinct. Because one thing is sure, that problems become more complex and increase in scope. And so there aren't any more sales problems that are only sales problems. There aren't any more production problems that are only production problems, etc. Mm-hmm. Any problem now requires ideas, information, knowledge from many, many people. And the way the ideas come together into solutions is what's going to determine, you know, the success of them. And for that success, we need other systems and other processes of collective problem solving, as opposed to the ones that we are still, trying to keep alive for too long already.
Yeah, that's another issue with the whole top-down hierarchical model, that we can't have someone at the top determining what criteria our ideas should have, since you're saying all the problems are so interconnected. And we know that if we knew what was relevant from the beginning, we would already have the answers. Some ideas that are going to come up might be excluded by default if we just have a bad criterion in place. So, but at the same time, we don't want to be too broad either. And like you said in the beginning, we need some form of hierarchical structure and sense of direction and exclusion, so we don't get information overload, because most information is irrelevant to a particular problem as well. All right, Bart, I thought we could end on my wife's question there. So what is your gripe with HR people or their methodology rather?
Yeah, it's different from ours, I would say. And the distinction between both is what I like to call you either learn stuff in the action or you learn it out of the action. And I'll have to explain what I mean with the action. The action is essentially the problem-solving action, and it ties to flow, and it's essentially the following logic. The HR methodologies, in my opinion, they take people out of their action, out of their daily action, out of their daily problems, out of the daily, you know, polarization they're in, or disagreements or justification battles they are fighting with other people. And you talk to them, you give them some models, frameworks, tips and tricks. You allow people to, let's say, you know, relieve some of their frustrations. And while that can be very, very valuable exchanges and very valuable moments, the problem is that most of our times in organizations we spend in the action. I guess I did a calculation once for myself, and it's more than 95% of the time that we spend in organizations doing problem solving, doing our work, interacting with our colleagues, being in meetings, doing, you know, preparatory work. And so if we want to find solutions for more engagement, more productivity, better problem solving, more cooperation, it's my belief that we will only find them in the action, in the way we solve problems, in the way we interact together in that problem solving activity. And so the models and the tips and the tricks that we sometimes hear from HR, but as well from the people you mentioned, like Tim Robbins, for me, it's very much out of the action. You cannot say that they're useless or that they're wrong, but I always have the question, you know, how? And so, like, basically, or often they come down to, people should come out of their comfort zone. We should open up. We should be acting as a team. And then my only question is, sure.
Yeah, how do we do that?
And the how is by definition only to be found in the action, only to be found around the problems that we're facing, around the ideas that we are allowed to have or not allowed to have, about the criticism that is either directed at us personally or directed at the idea, that is either, going to produce a major breakthrough or going to, get me even more frustrated. And so it's in the action that we're going to solve that. And so that is a little bit, and maybe again, I'm a little bit too black and white. The HR is often sometimes, and you can, you cannot blame them for that, but they're also disconnected from the problems. They don't deal with what kinds of things are being done or are being solved. And they take you out of that and they talk to you as a person. They try to understand your emotions, your feelings. They give you room and peace and quietness, if you want to digest and to come back to grip with some of the turmoil you may be going through. Yeah. Then when that ends again, you're back to square one sometimes, and it can start all over again, and you may not find a way to convert all of the discussions and the theory from those kinds of discussion into your actual reality and the reality of every day.
So you're saying that it's too separated from the actual problems that it's supposed to help you solve. You're saying that there's a distance between, it's too meta, it's too vague. You're just getting platitudes of, you gotta, even with flow. Yeah, you just gotta be in flow, but it's devoid of the idea that, how do I get there? How do I actually solve the problem? So it's diverting the attention away from the problem and into more irrelevant territory.
If you link it to what we were saying about flow, flow is only about your reality, about the reality of what you're doing and how you address that reality, how you structure that reality, how you capture progress of that reality. And so the only way you can ever find to learn to experience more flow is by being in the reality, by thinking about the reality and the reality of your problems, the reality of your progress, and the potential variations you can introduce, and then the effect of those variations, and then the impact of those variations on everything that comes. And the only place where you're ever going to find that out is, as we like to call it, is in the action and not out of the action. I have a good agreement with HR people. I want to make that clear. And I still see it as complementary. I don't see it as orthogonal or as conflicting. I see it as complementary, and people really can have, a boost from, pulling the plug for 1 hour or for a day or for even a sabbatical. I mean, I believe in all those kinds of things, but they are complementary to the area and the activity where I'm trying to find solutions.
Yeah. No, I think that's an important point too. And I started to think about, the idea of motivation ties into this too, because As far as I understand, HR people are meant to help motivate their colleagues and so on and so forth. And from what we've just discussed here, that is mostly a case of the external motivation again. We're relying on a certain person, to go back to the reductionism. You have the responsibility to motivate X amount of people, and we're going to send you to a leadership course where we're going to invest all this time and money in you to get the result we want, namely motivated individuals working in the company, rather than putting the emphasis on how do we intrinsically motivate each person, which I guess could come from somebody explaining the principles we've just talked about, but then allowing for the conditions for each person to motivate themselves rather than focusing on the HR people to hold that burden.
Yeah. And in a learning process, and knowing that learning, you know, evolves, and not, yeah, you know, dreaming or idealizing that with like the transactional thing of going to a training, that stuff is fixed when you get back from the training. So every learning is developmental, evolutionary, requires a process that needs to run for long enough time, and that needs to be subject to error correction as well in itself, the process. Learning is again an emergent phenomenon of that process. And so, you know, thinking that the transaction of going to a lecture, following a training, doing a coaching session as such fixes the problem is also, I think, to a large extent, a flaw in a lot of management thinking.
Yeah. So, Bart, this was a really fun conversation. I was in flow for sure. So that must be a good sign.
Well, I found it very exciting and fun as well, as all of my talks with you already. It's great to share our views around this. So
I'm glad to hear that. And so thank you. Thanks a lot for coming on. And where can people find out more about you?
So either on LinkedIn, where I'm posting a lot, or at my website, which is pactifymanagement.com.
Right. And I also encourage everyone to go check out your TED Talk. I will put a link in the description also of this episode. Have a great night.